Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. If you'd like to move down a little bit, I'd be grateful. It appears that we've been losing a little bit to the football this evening, and for those that are interested, which you clearly aren't or else you wouldn't be here, I'm told that Germany lost 2-0. And one can only... Did they not lose 2-0? Oh. I'm misinformed. Well, let's hope that later this evening England don't buck the current trend, which is all Eurozone in countries have so far beaten all Eurozone out countries, but we will see. I'd like to thank... begin by thanking Richard Layard, who first of all booked this room for us and helped organise this evening, but secondly and much more importantly, organised and coordinated all of the authors. And as you know, we have nine eminent economists who have put their names to this pamphlet, and economists are not famous for agreeing with each other, so when I was told that there were nine of them, I knew that the arguments were bound to be right. I'd also like to thank Adair, who was the spokesperson for the group prior to the publication this morning. It's a funny thing, this Europe debate, because when Britain in Europe was launched at the autumn of last year, the euro was falling very quickly, heading towards parity with the dollar and then crashing through 90 cents. Inward investors started warning that their margins were being squeezed, that the exports were being damaged. We ran a campaign in February called Out of Europe, Out of Work, and all that time, we were just told that we were scaremongering and nobody took any notice. But I think since the events at Longbridge, the whole environment of this debate has been transformed. As you all know, we currently have, or in the last few weeks have had, a 15-year record high in sterling against the Deutsche Mark and simultaneously a 6-year record low against the dollar. And all the warnings that came over the previous 12 months about the problem of the high pound turned out to not be scaremongering at all, but actually real people's jobs have been lost. And we saw in the Ernst & Young report, I think the week before last, that now Britain's share of new inward investment projects has actually started to fall. And the reason I say all that is because it's the context in which we published this pamphlet. The nine authors that Richard will talk to you about in a moment, I think, make the case very powerfully that being outside the single currency will forever be a problem for Britain because of the volatility of our currency. It's a very important contribution to the debate, which we're very proud to have published. We don't do so to call for the government to get off the fence and join the single currency now. Nobody wants to join when the economic conditions aren't right. But I think it is a powerful contribution that says there is going to be a continuing cost and a rising cost from staying out. So, Richard, please, come to the floor.
Well, I think our whole group wants to thank Britain and Europe for the splendid way in which they produced this pamphlet, all 15,000 copies of it, as I understand. When we first thought of this pamphlet in February, we hardly imagined that this would be such a topical subject when the pamphlet was published, and that, of course, is all to the good. The debate has certainly increased in volume, but perhaps less in quality. And I wanted to illustrate the problem that I think we're up against here, and I know that this is an element of preaching to the converted this evening. It is the deep public ignorance. I took a straw poll at the tennis club last night. What are the main advantages of the euro, of Britain joining the euro? One said saving money at the airport. Another said lower inflation. Nobody mentioned increases in national prosperity and increases in productivity from joining a large market with a single currency like the US and thereby being able to achieve the kind of productivity and prosperity that we see in the US. I also asked what were the disadvantages of not joining, and I found nobody really understood about floating. Some people mentioned the high pound, but the notion that it wasn't just the pound being high now, but the fact of the pound moving up and down unpredictably, sometimes overvalued, sometimes undervalued, discouraging firms from entering foreign markets. This was not something that anybody present was aware of. We do go in the pamphlet into some length to try and document the evidence that separate currencies are barriers to trade and barriers to the efficient allocation of capital. And we then point out the peculiar position of Britain, which used to be one of many countries which had different currencies from each other, and is now next to a group of countries which have pooled their currency and therefore eliminated the disadvantages which they formerly experienced, thereby putting us in a new position where, whereas if we were selling into, say, Germany, we were no more disadvantaged than other European countries selling into Germany from different currencies. And now we are disadvantaged, and therefore, of course, companies will be increasingly tempted to produce within the euro area what they sell within the euro area. We also point out the fact that, on the whole, exchange rate stability is likely to increase as it becomes ever easier to exchange currencies. And that this is really the reason why people who think deeply about these things, and as an economist, I'm bound to say that I'm thinking in particular of the world's leading international macroeconomists. Having done a little poll in the last few days, I find that nearly all the world's leading macroeconomists think Britain should join the euro because separate currencies are becoming increasingly difficult to sustain in a world of hot money. So that's a little background to why we felt it was necessary to put out a report. I think you know the membership, you've got it there. To present the report in a second, we will have Adair Turner, followed by Peter Kennan of Princeton University, who is spending some time in Britain at the moment, fortunately. He has been a leading expert on these issues for 30 years and more, a moving spirit in the Group of 30, author of a book on the Maastricht Treaty. So he will be giving, as it were, an outside perspective, a non-British perspective on this debate. But what I really wanted to stress is it's been a really lovely group. I thought Simon was going to say that we might have had some difficulty in reaching agreement, but he didn't, and we haven't. We've been very much of one mind, but we've been actually a very hard-working group. That's been a lot of work for the person who had to try and conflate the different suggestions for presentation of the arguments. Everybody has put in an enormous amount of time into this. Particularly pleased, of course, to have got Robert Mundell, Nobel Prize winner and author of the most famous article on optimum currency areas, to join in, and Paul Volcker, former chairman of the Federal Reserve. All the members have been extremely important. Willem Buiten, somewhere? There he is, having a drink. made a very nice presentation for us at lunchtime today. Chris Hune, also here somewhere. Chris was also presenting a very powerful view from his position as a member of the European Parliament. And we've also had great help from Will Hutton and David Curry. So without any further, let me ask Adair to present our report.
Richard, thank you very much. When I gave up doing the CBI job on December the 31st, I made a New Year's resolution that hopefully forever, and that certainly for at least a year of my life, I would never get up at 6:15 to do the Today programme, and certainly not to discuss the euro. Now, unfortunately, something went wrong with that, and at 6:15 this morning, I was on the Today programme discussing the euro. And I'd just like to ponder on why that is. Well, partly It has to do with Richard's persuasiveness and his interesting persuasion technique. What Richard does is, first of all, he says, Adair, there is a group of people already writing a pamphlet which we would quite like you to add your name to, but you don't have to do any work. And you certainly don't have to do anything with launching it. And you sort of say, after a while, well, okay, I'll do that. After you've got in that stage, he says, well, there is one meeting that I would like you to come where we discuss the major arguments. After one meeting where you discuss the major arguments, there are early drafts to be discussed and particular areas which Richard in particular thinks you in particular ought to focus on. And slow it progresses till about 2 weeks ago when he said that he really thought I ought to do the Today programme at 6:15. And he used the old Chinese approach that philately will get you everywhere, and said that I would clearly be the person best able to deal with the rough and tumble of politics, whereas all these pure economists apparently can't deal with that rough and tumble effectively. And so it was. At least one reason why I was there at 6:15 this morning is that Richard persuaded me. I have to tell Richard that that is it for the year. I'm not producing another pamphlet, and I'm certainly not appearing on the Today programme at 6:15. But there was another reason, and I guess the reason is this. This is clearly a vitally important issue for this country, and it is an issue which so far is dealt with very badly indeed in public debate. Now, a lot of us know that intuitively. Few of us have that wonderful faith in human nature that we try out our tennis club in the hope that we are going to get a rational discussion of the euro. Some of us know in advance that this is a formula for awful comments of no great intellectual merit. There clearly is a need to try and raise the quality of the debate and to put forward the economic arguments. Now, I don't say that on the basis of the belief that this referendum will be won by the economic arguments. I think in many ways, all of us who like to be interested in good argument, in intellectual argument, in economic arguments, in clear arguments of early thought, have to accept that a referendum on this issue will probably be, for those of us of a fastidious intellectual nature, an absolute horror story, in which the other side will use a totally dumbed-down arguments, and to win it, we'll probably have to use dumbed-down arguments in return. Anybody who observed the French referendum on Maastricht in 1992 will have noticed the awful tendency by which this works. The French referendum on Maastricht, if you were going through the French countryside at that time, had absolutely nothing to do with the Maastricht Treaty whatsoever. It was almost entirely fought, certainly in the French countryside, on the basis of the Common Agricultural Policy and GATT, neither of which were affected at all by the Maastricht Treaty. That, however, is democracy, and we have to accept that. And I certainly have always been, despite the dangers of that, a supporter of a referendum, believing, and I think it was Churchill who originally said it, that democracy is the worst possible system of government apart from any other system of government that you can think of. Despite all that, however, I think there is a crucial need to state in as rational form as possible, which is what this document tries to do, the economic argument. To state it in a way which has some intellectual credibility as an argument of economists, but which hopefully, and that's what we've aimed for, is accessible to the general reader. And the particular reason why I think it's important to state the economic argument for, as one among the panoply of arguments that will be put forward for the euro, is that I think too often the antis in this case get away with the belief that economists are against this. I think it's too easy for them to get away with the belief that whereas practical business people are in favour of it, and maybe politicians in the Foreign Office are in favour of it, economists are against it because that's where economic theory takes you. Certainly when I was at the CBI, I would often meet journalists, city journalists, economics correspondents, who would say, Adair, I can't believe that you're for this thing. I understand why you have to reflect the sort of rather mundane intellectual standards of your West Midlands metal bashers who sort of want a fixed exchange rate simply because it would make life easy for them. But you surely shouldn't accept that. You ought to have higher intellectual standards, and surely you, even if not they, have heard of the one-size-fits-all interest rate policy, and isn't that a sort of knockout feature which should make you sort of collapse in intellectual shame at being attached to the pro-cause? I have always believed very strongly that this is an area of economics where not so much a little knowledge, but an intermediate level of knowledge is a very dangerous thing. That we are dealing with an area of economics where you have the attitude of practical business people, which is to favor stability, where the next level of intellectual complexity is to discover that there are some problems with that, that there are problems of one-size-fits-all interest rate policies and optimal currency areas, but that the level beyond that, when you really think it through, is actually in favor of Europe being an optimal currency zone. Now, in order deliberately to annoy the skeptics, what I say is that when you do A-level economics, you learn that there are these wonderful things called floating exchange rates. Floating exchange rates which move in a marvelously smooth and useful fashion precisely to offset problems of differences in the competitiveness of countries and problems of differential inflation rates, and that once you've learnt that, and if you never get beyond A-level economics, you are clearly and forever in favour of floating exchange rates. The problem is that in the real world, that is not how exchange rates operate. I don't think anybody who has ever walked into a foreign exchange dealing room and seen the behaviour of foreign exchange dealers, not one of the prettiest sights in human life, has ever been of the belief that foreign exchange rates are smoothly and perfectly and rationally moving exchange rate mechanisms. And so I do think this is a case where it is actually important, not because it will win the argument, but as part of the arguments, to put forward an intellectual case and a case which argues that, correctly understood, there is a strong case for optimal currency areas in the world. And I think this is a general case, being somewhat bigger than they are in general, though I suspect I would not go far as perhaps one of the authors of the pamphlet would go, which is Robert Mundell, who I think gets pretty close to saying that even the whole world might be an optimal currency area. I would stick at the point of saying that the number of optimal currency areas in the world is less than the number of present currencies, but greater than one, which is a good economist statement, allowing lots of opportunity for debate within it. I'm not going to say more about what's in the argument of the pamphlet, because anybody who hasn't read it has got to read it, because one of the points of what we're trying to put over in this pamphlet is that there is a need for people to discuss this issue with the level of intellectual seriousness which is required to read this pamphlet. And one of the great difficulties of going on today programme on a subject like this is it is extremely difficult, as everybody knows, to express the complexity of arguments on this issue in anything like the 30-second sound bites that one is allowed. I'd like to just end, though, with just saying a few words about the politics, because one of the difficulties, of course, that we've had this weekend is that the journalists only want to ask, well, what are you trying to achieve with this pamphlet in political terms rather than what are the arguments in economics terms? And I think we didn't quite know when we set the date for the launch of this pamphlet that it was going to be so difficult to detach what we are saying from the politics of it. We didn't know quite what was going to happen over the previous 2 weeks. All I would say is this. We clearly have, in Gordon Brown, a Chancellor who has a clear point of view, which is that there is some magic point in about 18 months to 2 years in which it will be possible to analyse 5 economic tests, but that it is at the moment completely impossible to say anything about them whatsoever. I find this not an entirely credible point of view. I say that with a great deal of trepidation because Bob Worcester has just told me that this is an entirely credible and reasonable political strategy. And, of course, the point about Bob is that he always has more facts than anybody else, and therefore it's very dangerous of me to suggest that. I am not of the belief that the government should necessarily name a date for a referendum, even be more definitive that it is for. But what I am sure of is that we cannot go forward pretending that this debate cannot occur. I think we are in a very difficult situation otherwise for those of us who are for the euro, that we end up trapped in saying, there are arguments in principle for the euro, but I'm not going to tell you what they are yet, because that's part of a sort of Christmas present which is going to come after the next election. I think it's important, therefore, above all, in an environment where politicians are constrained by the complexities of the political tactics, that organizations like Britain in Europe and the group of people who've been authors of this report try and make a case which sets out arguments in principle which do not point us towards a specific date, but which prepare the fundamental intellectual ground which at least I hope will play at least the smallest part in the winning of a referendum in favour. Thank you very much.
What Adair does not know is that every time Adair sent in voluminous comments on one of Richard's drafts, Richard dropped by my office next door to make sure that he'd done justice to Adair's comments in his latest revision. This came from the consequence of proximity. Not that I was necessarily the best person to answer those questions, but I happened to be in the next office. And I thank Richard for the opportunity to participate in this effort. I am quite amazed by the change which has taken place on my side of the Atlantic. At lunch today, where some of you were present, I told the story of the two American economists attending a conference on emu. They were the only two economists. One got up and gave his speech, and when he finished, the other got up to leave. He got up to leave, and the other man looked at him and said, "No, I'm sorry, you can't leave." He says, "I'm the other speaker." That was roughly the state of affairs. There was very little interest in the United States in this subject, and there was considerable skepticism about both the desirability and the feasibility of monetary union in Europe. There were a few of us who felt from the start that it was both feasible and desirable. I count myself as one of them. Those who are skeptical today, obviously it's feasible, it's happened. Those who are skeptical about the future of EMU are really the minority now. And when I talk to American economists about the question of British participation, the question I get is not should Britain participate, but when are they going to get around to it? They see it as the natural consequence of membership in the single market and in the community as a whole. They see it as something that does have profound implications for the character of European economic unification, not political unification. They see it as offering opportunities for capturing the kinds of economies of scale and of efficiency which the single market holds out in principle, but which the single currency will help realize. The U.S.-Canadian example is mentioned in the pamphlet, and it is a striking one. There is very much more trade between, say, two Canadian provinces than there is between a Canadian province and a U.S. state of roughly comparable size or distance. Now, there are many things that stand at that border that prevent the volume of trade from being the same in the two cases. But more and more of us are convinced, on the basis of fairly firm empirical evidence, that currency uncertainty is one of them, that it is much harder to conduct business efficiently across an exchange rate than it is within a single currency area. In the United States, and I offer this example to my students, a firm in my state, New Jersey, which had to think in terms of 50 separate dollars trading with New York, Pennsylvania, and so forth, would find it unthinkable. We take the single currency in the United States for granted. I'm not talking about changing a few dollar bills at the state border. I'm talking about keeping accounts, doing pricing, doing investment decisions, making long-term contracts of various kinds. The single currency is the cement which unifies the American market and makes possible the sorts of nationwide investment planning, worldwide investment planning, that we have in the United States and that Europe will have. By staying out, essentially, Britain deprives itself of that, not simply in the sense that some firms will invest elsewhere and not in Britain, but that British firms themselves will be handicapped in their business with Europe. It seems to me that's the most important point. No other option, it seems to me, makes sense for the UK. There is no transatlantic relationship that can substitute for the trans-channel relationship. There is no, to talk of a free trade area with the United States, possibly, but a free trade area with the United States would be a free trade area between Europe and the United States, not between Britain and the United States. Let's face that. There may be some people in this country and some people in my country who think that an English-speaking alliance is possible. No. The United States, if it were interested in an Atlantic free trade area, would be interested in a free trade area with the EU, not the US. And there's no question of a single currency. The relationship with the United States is an important one, but it gains importance from our point of view in the United States because Britain is in Europe, not because Britain stands alone and apart from Europe. And it's Britain's influence in Europe which makes for that partnership with the United States and makes it a special relationship. It is not Britain standing alone beside the United States. And those who talk about that are just being utterly unrealistic, I think, speaking from the standpoint of someone who sits on the other side of the Atlantic most of the time. I think Britain has an opportunity and must not, frankly, waste that opportunity. Britain has gotten itself into various European endeavors too late to influence their shape. It still has an enormous opportunity to influence the shape of the single market, not the shape of the monetary union, that's written down in Maastricht, but the shape of the single market and of the financial and other arrangements that will go with it over time. It risks being excluded as more and more decisions are taken de facto, if not de jure, by the Euro 11, soon to be the Euro 12. And I would remind you, as I did today at lunch, that it's not just the Euro 12, it's the Czech Republic, it's Hungary, it's Poland, it's a good number of others who will be members of that area, highly competitive, highly skilled labor forces, attractive investment platforms in the future. It's not just the existing 11, it's the future monetary union that has to be looked at, and the cost of exclusion from that is even larger than the cost of exclusion from the present monetary union. I hope that economic reasoning will carry at least some weight, as it air hopes, in the debate to come. But I think the premise is right. The issues have to be stated now. The quality of the argument will only deteriorate as the referendum approaches. And it is now, especially now, that the economic case has to be made and has to be made effectively. I hope we've helped.
Well, thank you very much, Adair and Peter. That was tremendous. Just to mention that Bob Mundell, our co-author, will be putting his version of our case at a breakfast meeting here on Thursday, one floor below this, at 8:30 to 9:30. If there are people here who haven't been invited and are interested in being invited, please come and talk to one of us, and we'll make sure that you are, let's hope all our collective efforts meet with success. Thank you.